Hello, my name is Monica Lipschitz, and this is the second Rupert Open Studio podcast from season 2. The conversation with Omsk Social Club, Rupert's resident, in February 2022 was recorded on February 23rd, one day before the war in Ukraine started. Like for most of the people in Eastern Europe, it took time for me to find a mind space to go back to the subjects other than the war. It's been more than a month now since we recorded this conversation. Then I started thinking that this constant switching between the social media news and chats with people affected by the war in Ukraine and the almost impossible normality of the daily life here, right now, this switching, this liminal space, is somewhat similar to what Omsk is calling bleed between the two lived worlds. Omsk Social Club's work is created between two lived worlds, one of life as we know it and the other of role play, coming from LARP or live action role play. The two worlds bleed into one and move into a territory Omsk coined in 2017 called real game play. This term describes the working process of Omsk and has become a stimulus for experimentation to reshape new cultural value systems for interdependence, world crafting, and cooperation. I'm grateful for Omsk for sharing the time and exchanging thoughts on what is what. Looking from the perspective of multiple realities, could it be easier to face the so-called reality? I hope you enjoy listening.
And I mean, of course, like it's, you know, distrusting the government. I can fully get on board with that. But I think there was like a lot more to distrust about the government before COVID, like,
yeah.
You know.
So, hi.
Hello.
I'm really happy that you agreed to join for a podcast today. Let's speak about Omsk Social Club. And one of the things that I got really interested and fascinated by the fact that you use LARP as, I don't know, you will correct me if it's a method or if it's an entry point or I don't know, but it's very interesting that you use it as a source, right, to develop entities, concepts, characters, and whatever. So how did it start? How did Omsk Social Club start? And how did LARP appear?
Firstly, thank you for having me. And I mean, it's kind of interesting because in a way, I think a lot of people assume that Omsk Social Club kind of resonates in LARP, and it definitely has trails or like tentacles that feed into live action role play. But this was like really only understood or examined when coming into contact with LARP communities and LARP thematics, because in a sense, I think where Omsk sits is a place called Bleed, which the LARP community very often refers to, but very often speaks to it on how to avoid this place called Bleed. Because in terms of the LARP community, quite often, which is also extremely diverse and experimental, but quite often within the mainframe of LARP, mostly looking through a kind of Nordic LARPing lens, European LARPing lens, is that there is a world set up, which often they refer to as opening a magic circle. And within that magic circle, there are specific characters and stories and thematics and a game master. And that game master creates pathways for the participants to role play within. And what is very kind of strongly positioned between LARP and like everyday or consensual reality is that there is this magic circle and that is open and closed. And outside of this magic circle is what the LARP community refer to as bleed. And this is a sort of hallway or edge between a role-played world and our everyday world. And this is quite often that the LARP community tries at all costs to avoid their participation landing in this field called bleed. And mostly what you find with bleed is, if you look at bleed and LARP in the internet forums, is that people speak a lot about this notion of bleed in terms of love. That when, if you are taking on a role that has like a romantic relationship inside a role-played imagined world, and you become so heavily invested in that relationship, then when you leave that role-played world, like, you still feel that sense of like desire and loss for the love that you don't have in consensual everyday reality. And this is very hard for people to deal with, you know, as any absent or unrequited love would be. And that also a lot of people find it quite disruptive to their everyday lived world. You know, if you're in this relationship and then you have this amazing role-played relationship and you're like, can't quite forget that person. But of course, that person is a character at the end of the day. And so these types of phenomena, there seems to be a kind of typical stance in the LARP world that they should be kind of avoided because there's not the kind of tool set to be able to cushion or deal with this phenomena in order to not hurt people when they return to everyday world. Saying that, this is like, this bleed space is very much where OMSK has always positioned its work. And this is mostly actually from a completely different type of role-played space, and that's mostly from like subcultural resonance that the people who participate within OMSK typically grew up in. So like the core of OMSK is very much heavily involved in activist left-wing spaces, alternative club culture, and in a sense these formations of like social contracts often actually exist in these parallel worlds that sit in opposition to consensual reality. In terms of like, you know, sometimes you can have like decentralized or much more radical queer phenomenology activated in these landscapes. And this, I think, was very much the initial inspiration of like how these worlds can open up, and they are in a sense durational. You know, whether you are at a club night for 10, 12 hours that like then lends itself into like the morning, the afternoon, you're sort of trying to survive together through this kind of brutality of staying up all night. And in a sense, like, you know, those long club nights can feel a little bit like trying to survive or navigate the real world again, is sort of gamified. Similarly, within like left-wing culture, if you're like blockading something, there's a certain sense of like duration, alliance, like the allies, the packs, the group of dissidents against the authority of the police. Like, how do you navigate like the urban sphere? What is like architecture? And so these are really the kind of places, I think, that like role play and the notion of like terraforming pockets of other worlds really kind of took root in OMSK. And I think that when we found out about LARP as a concept and as a historical entertainment process, it became very obvious that like LARP could be really utilized as a tool to manifest testbed spaces, so that you're not necessarily at the club or on the streets, but you can still manifest these testbeds of social groupings, where people can participate and explore and experiment and intervene and begin to sculpt and channel sets and settings. And because in a way, it's very hard to leave one's political roots. I think that's very much where like the term or the understanding or interest to work in bleed became very apparent, because these worlds that we want to open, they're also worlds that you can take things from into our everyday world, or that you can take from the everyday into the game-played world. And so that you can, I guess it's like, this is like kind of the most amazing thing about art, that somehow art practices, they allow the world to slow down. And, you know, we can deal with very traumatic or difficult subject matter within art because we have like a space of reflection to allow us to process. You know, I think that there's some absolutely amazing works of art that allow us to deal with very, very, very traumatic positions. And because it's not happening to us, IRL, in the moment, and we're not fighting against it, like we can actually evoke a certain procedure or a certain set of, yeah, for want of a better word, reflections. And then once you've gained that knowledge, like then you can apply it to whatever you do next. And so I think in terms of like Omsk, there's very much this notion of like the play that cannot be performed, and that these spaces, like you do learn from them. And those things, they might be things that they're not always progressive learnings. Like those things might be something like really difficult that you find out about yourself that you really do not want to be faced with. And I think also in terms of like the people who come and participate within Omsk's work are also extremely strong characters who are quite interested in undoing or loosening these like social paradigms of the self. And so it's always as well, like I think the richness of the work is really down to the people that it draws in. These people who are like kind of not afraid of questioning what is reality and who are they and how many roles do they play and how do you have to relinquish power and begin to set up collaborative, collective storytelling in order to experience something, and how do you live and breathe inside irrational space? Because when you create an imaginary world that is fairly irrational, when you have to live, or you decide, I should even say, decide to live in an artwork for 58 hours, or in the case of a work that we did a couple of summers ago, 58 days, you know, where you like literally are sleeping, breathing, eating inside an imaginary world. That's it's a commitment to seeing a work of art. Like, yeah, so that's hopefully loosened some of the structures that we're working with.
It's fascinating how you delve deep, and already from your first answer, you can understand how much actually Omsk Social Club have built in these years, right? It's like, I mean, as a practice, how many years is for Omsk Social Club?
Since 2017.
So that 5 years.
Yeah.
Right?
It feels longer. Yeah, I mean, especially considering for the last 2.5 years, it's been quite difficult to put these works on because of the pandemic.
Mm.
But I mean, there's been thousands and thousands of people who've played and participated over those 5 years, so, which is actually quite phenomenal.
It's very interesting how you put how actually rave culture is also like kind of a birthplace of Om Social Club, that in a way it is this area where either the memories or experiences from the rave, it comes here. So could you reflect a little bit more on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of it is, there's something about rave spaces, the kind of etymology of sacrifice that goes on in them. And I mean, also, you know, this, the notion of sacrifice is to make something sacred. And I guess what Omsk tries to create, or at least the closest that I can imagine is easy for people who haven't participated within the work to have experienced, is that that moment within a rave space where a stranger can suddenly be your best friend, that you can spend hours upon hours chatting in a toilet cubicle, or you can watch the sun come up, or how everything is suddenly shared, and like the lack of ownership, the transition of emotion, how everything is kind of accepted. You know, somebody can be completely freaking out in tears, hysteria, breaking, and another can be on their best high in this complete euphoric state, and how those spaces, they accept every emotion. There is not something that is politically correct or cannot be managed by the community of strangers that are participating within it. And the way in which your body is put to its limits, it's also, I mean, rave space is by its very nature an anti-capitalist structure. You render the body useless for work if you stay up dancing all night, ingesting chemicals rather than vitamins. And this in a way is an anti-capitalist war machine, regardless of where the music is coming from. But I think also, like, growing up in the UK, like, music was always very politicized, and especially when it comes to like free parties or spaces that sat outside of the bureaucratic system of experience economy. Also, you know, post Margaret Thatcher, all of these things like very much created these breakages, or like hyper performances, or liminal space. I mean, also like in terms of like culture, rave space, like within a UK context, also has like a lot of amazing contemporary philosophy around it, whether that comes from probably, you know, the most well-known source of like Mark Fisher and his ontologies, and, you know, the way in which like actually music played such an important role. Like Burial, for example, was like a heavily influential source. But there's also, you know, many, many others that very much rooted this kind of like cognitive reorganization through subcultures.
Yeah, it seems like there is a big role for community. And that this community is creating a space where it's really hard to call it alternative. It's, you know, I mean, I think in general, in creating multiple realities, there is no hegemony anymore between which space is more real than the other.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is like kind of interesting in terms of this notion of like construction Because I think that, you know, if we, it's interesting because I was having this conversation with Vida, and we were talking about this notion that construction, and if we agree that everything is a construction, Vida was proposing that this could be a sort of end point. Like, how do you kind of captivate or hold on to progressing if you then believe that everything is a construction? There's a certain sort of existentialism or nihilism situated within it. But then it was super beautiful that we got to this moment, because then, like, for me, I was like, yeah, but if we understand everything is a construction, like, then surely we can also begin constructing. Like, you know, there's something about taking away the power of construction if we believe that everything is there. So, I mean, who has the authority to make reality? Like, you know, and I think this is also very interesting in terms of role play, because you agree with a certain number of people, that could be 20 people who are complete strangers to you. You agree that the reality that you predominantly exist in doesn't exist any longer for however many hours. And what is that space then? You know, is that like a hallucination? How many people need to begin to hallucinate before it becomes a reality? You know, this sort of like educational drama, or, you know, are we in fact always hallucinating all of the time, and the only time we agree on the hallucination is actually reality, but it's still another shade of hallucination. So yeah, I don't know. I think, like, sometimes I feel as if I'm like completely insane when I talk about Omsk, because I think that, like, there's such deep kaleidoscope of obsessions there, that have only they only grow in my need or want to, like, unpick them further. And I guess that's also can become, yeah, a little unhinged when you begin to subvert, like, this kind of reality script that we know. But I guess also what I think is really important about working in the art world is that it gives a lot of freedom, and it's actually a kind of quite a safe space, because I think, like, we're so lucky to be able to expand our minds in this way. I mean, I think, like, if I talked about these sort of things outside of an art context, under Western medicine, I would be seen to have, like, a psychological problem. And sure. So, yeah, I think there's something also very exciting about having this carte blanche that, or using art as a sort of cloak and a veil, to experiment and to situate these potentially destabilizing ideas and conversations. And I think that's, yeah, what Oms keeps coming back to.
Yeah. And because in a way, you are here, well, maybe not to sound so grand, to write the history, well, to reflect a little bit. But I wanted to ask also, maybe in the relationship, because LARP is primarily coming, you know, from historical situations, enacting historical situations. But also, what, I just had it marked on my notes somewhere after a conversation with you. What does it have to do with history? whatever that means. And I think it comes from our conversation. You spoke about Reza Nagarastani saying that forgetting is like an asset and we should forget everything. And actually, I just wanted to ask, as abstract as it is, what is Omsk's relationship with history?
That's a really interesting question. I think in terms... Okay, hold on. I need to say this not randomly.
Yeah.
Like, not crazily. So his, like, we cannot ever leave history in my mind. In the same way that even when we are playing a character, we're role-playing another person, we will never get rid of ourselves. And that's also why I think we were so interested in this circumference of bleed, because it allowed for the leak of oneself, one's history, the history of the world. And in a way, it's a little bit like these traditional notions of, like, Octavia Butler. She said that her writing wasn't necessarily sci-fi, but actually cautionary tales, which looped history, but also offered the, you know, 1,000 views of what that could be. And I think in terms of these 1,000 views, I think that's also super interesting with this idea of history. Like, there's not one history. You know, I think there is a prominent history, but if we think about the near future, we see, like, a multitude of possibilities. But then when we talk about history, we speak about the singularity almost. And that's actually very, I think, interesting and unusual, because are we saying that we agree on a singular line of history, of time and space, which also... are we not coerced by that? Because, you know, the beginning of one civilization is like the dramatic end of another. That is the defeat of power, the erasure of culture and structures that have been before that. And, you know, the violence of the archive, the violence of the myth, the violence of the story and the narrative have always favored the successor of the story. And so in terms of role play and Omsk, I think that there's like a sort of like healthy moment to not forget history, but to provide an uncertainty of what went before. And that uncertainty, I think, for a lot of people is very hard to deal with, because if you cannot capture a foundation, it's very hard for a lot of people to build from it. But actually, we cannot really hold a weight to what we believe has come before. And I think, yeah, in that way, Omsk deals with the momentarily allowing history to become uncertain. And I think that's also disempowering for dominant authority-making narratives that we live with. And I think that we're really, really lucky to be almost kind of living in a time where a lot of history, in terms of whether that be female or people of color or different spiritual beliefs, a lot of this history is becoming unearthed at the moment, and it's becoming accepted as like a tooling of like the future. And I think, like, yeah, this is also very much a disruption of that history. And I think that that's something that, like, yeah, we're trying to play with. And of course, you know, being based in Berlin, always at the back of one's mind is, you know, amazing thinkers like Hannah Arendt, who, of course, very much reject like the forgetting of history and for very good reasons. And I think that's not, that's definitely not what role play is, because I think you truly cannot forget. Because this is, it's like always like a yo-yo effect. And also, yeah, no, maybe I just want to leave that at there. Like,
yeah, I mean,
it's a very, very hard question.
If you want, we can think about it further later. I mean, if you come with more reflections regarding that question. But, you know, this question came to my mind thinking about Omsk Social Club, also here as reflecting on the real gameplay.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I wanted to ask you about the real gameplay, the term that you coined, and what is the relationship with LARP and real gameplay, what is the connection and what is the real gameplay? How do you call it?
Yeah, I think we came up with this term because in a way, real gameplay is like very much about playing the real world, which I think, we kind of unpacked a little bit before. But I think as well, it became kind of important to also not take or reappropriate the terminology of LARP, because LARP has a huge community. It has a very specific set of interests and parameters, and it's also done a lot in terms of building this community and building this lineage and this history. And I think the art world has a little bit of thoughtless side that we just pick up terms and then begin to like use them and formulate within them. And then kind of the original context or the original bodies, social bodies that constructed those terms are typically diluted with what the art world makes of them. And so not to remove the inspiration that LARP has had on Omsk, but instead to show it as a fork of these ideas. And also, I mean, I think that the reasons why we make work, why we make real gameplays, as I spoke about before, these kind of notions of reality system design or creating like cultural difference or distance in order to then manipulate or manifest within our everyday worlds. These are not necessarily the terms and drives of the LARP community. And so it seemed important to negotiate a new set of terminology when creating this work. And I think it's also important to say that, you know, when we're opening these worlds up, there's also like a lot of background work. So everybody who participates within these worlds, you know, they do like an 8-hour workshop before. And these workshops, they don't just utilize methodology that's key to traditional LARP models or improvised theater, but they also work with like trancing, bodying, channeling, sensory deprivation tactics, like the release of chemicals that naturally are produced in our bodies, such as DMT. And so there's kind of like there's a lot of tools that Omsk uses that maybe sit more within traditional ritual and magic work than inside the role-playing community. I think for us it seemed kind of important to to find a new set of terms that we could sculpt and build onto, whilst not forgetting the kind of amazing work that has already been done with them.
And now, so for example, how do you use those experiences from real gameplay further in your work? Or is it already, well, in a way, of course, maybe, okay, maybe it's a stupid question, because actually real gameplay is already an, how to say, an artwork, right? It is already, and then like the further you, for example, inside you created characters, so then they travel further as works of art?
Yeah, I mean, that really depends on the world, actually. So some of them just stay as real gameplays and nothing comes out of them. As some of them are documented in certain ways, and then these kind of relics or artifacts are drawn out and can be exhibited further, which also translate the transcripts of the topics that were explored during those real gameplays. And then other ones, there is actually entirely new works come out of them. So for example, this longest piece that we did called Unrealism, which was 58 days, continually live, 24/7, which basically was one player inside an apartment for 58 days trying to live online. And through this notion of this character who saw themselves as a multi-being or an avatar or a kind of glitch chimera between human and I guess like meta being, they had this community around them, which were also people in their own private spaces, and then they had the World Wide Web at large, and this was their kind of playing field. And from that, actually, a book was written called Heart of the Avatar, a preliminary document of the internet, which is, you know, like an 8-chapter, 200-page book that was just released, actually, on Saturday by Folia. And, you know, then that book almost becomes like a set of keys or relics from this real gameplay. And it's very much written from the character who is living the character's life, living inside, and was written out of the world, but the book exists inside this world. Another work that we did last summer called Utopiets was a work that 8 of us did under the influence of LSD, which was very much inspired by this notion that LSD was actually one of the main impetuses or inspirations to the world of virtual and augmented reality that we live in today. And so we decided to go under LSD for around 8 hours, 8 different characters, and explore the kind of genealogy of this drug. And we were all mic'd up when we did it. So then we basically had this archive of our conversations under the influence. And we were also utilizing Timothy Leary's university techniques of like research that and extractive note-taking that he was doing before he kind of got kicked out of university and became this enfant terrible of psychedelics across America. And from that work, we actually created a play that was first premiered on Kashmir Radio in Berlin. And then from that, actually, we became super interested in this topic. And there's 2 characters of that then continued and did this performative lecture, which shows all these different alternative realities and genealogies of virtual reality, including this really beautiful circular timeline. And this was actually shown at Ljubljana Biennial, where we were also showing a lot of the research and mark making that we'd created. So there's a huge installation there for the Biennial. And actually, at the moment, we were very lucky to be supported by the Berliner Senate to actually write a new book from these two characters who are writing a book about the alternative genealogy of virtual reality through less of a kind of white Silicon Valley scientific lens, but more through looking at different movements, very intersectional positions, sci-fi, religion, chemicals, literature, people like, I mean, honestly, I think like Sun Ra came up with the concept of virtual reality because, I mean, he declared that his orchestra was basically playing notes and sections of music that would transport person to a different reality. And so, yeah, this book is like looking at all these different case studies across history about how the body can transcend or like move space. I mean, even thinking in terms of like, you know, the Xerox, like the photocopier, very, very heavily changed the protest movement of the Black Panthers by allowing them to transcend from their body onto a piece of paper and their souls and voices to be distributed when it was far too dangerous for their bodies to literally be on the street. And, you know, these are all sentiments of like utilizing an avatar. And also all these things kind of came up in this conversation that we originally had when we were on LSD in this real gameplay. And so, yeah, there's like a lot of really, I think, fantastic or interesting ideas come up in this role-play space that then we bring back to consensual everyday reality and like look deeper into them. So I guess like real gameplay functions as two things. Like firstly, it could function as a living artwork itself, and the second as like a kind of methodology or, yeah, inspirational research trip to like another world and then coming back. Like
research trip to another world, exactly. Well put. But now when you talk, I also just comes to my mind that there are some kind of similarities with some theater practices.
Yeah. I mean, I think also, like, for example, I think, like, you know, there's also really amazing philosophers and who were theater directors and theater thinkers, like, Aton Atuet, like, I mean, his like whole notion of the theater of cruelty, you know, how even like he seeped into, you know, the body without organs is actually like a line in one of his plays, which of course heavily influenced Deleuze and Guattari. And, you know, they're these kind of systems of layering or scripting, I think, are like very, very heavily drawn to, yeah, systems of reality. And even to think about how like signs and objects is objects and processes like on stage become part of, you know, we're also sitting in a stage right now. You know, we're sitting in Rupert's residency stage.
literally in the stage.
But it's staged as, you know, like it would be kind of mad if like there was a swimming pool in here right now or something like that. Because, you know, I think this also comes back to this like real gameplay or, you know, this readable reality. You know, we're also playing roles. Like, You're asking me questions. I'm answering questions. If I decided to, I don't know, start reading a book right now, it would make your role pretty hard. Similarly, like if I was having a residency in a swimming pool, it might also make it kind of hard. So that we're also, you know, we're constantly negotiating roles and sets, like everywhere in our lives.
I mean, similarity with a theater is just like that it's an agreed space, you know, that it's like an agreed space, so, yeah. An agreed role, and there are certain methods. And in a way, you have to believe the role, you have to put yourself in the role, you know, like in ancient Greek philosophy, that like as an actor, you are a vessel.
Yeah,
and you put yourself inside with the minds of the character, and so on. And it's actually very interesting when those worlds are leaking. And
yeah.
As you say, that like, you know, the character produces a book that is alive here in this world.
Yeah,
so those connections are very beautiful, and I mean, kind of as a means of transportation. You know, it itself is already with a meaning.
Yeah.
The very transportation, the very vehicle.
I mean, it's interesting when you were saying that, I was also thinking about, well, you know, in a sense, like theater is like ritual, right? And like, you know, what's a ritual? It's also a space of like manifestation. It's a place of leaking. It's a place of like opening a liminality and seeing kind of what comes out. It's also very symbolic. Symbology is very important, and yeah, I think in terms of like real gameplay, like the ritual and the manifestation is very unharnessed, but still very important. And I think it's something that I don't fully understand myself. but there is somehow like magic that that comes out of that landscape. And I think like magic is something that you just literally can't find words for. Like you cannot describe it. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question right now.
But I'm just like, I'm just like trying to understand, because it sounds that worlding is very similar. Most of it is similar, but how it's very connected to real gameplay, because as a result of real gameplay, in the long term, you create a lot of worlds.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of really amazing practitioners who are playing with these subjects at the moment.
Yeah.
I think Ian definitely is. There's also Ed Fornelis, brilliant close practitioner, who's also making chapters of worlds. I think, yeah, there's Joey Holder, also amazing world crafter. Maybe in certain frames, Jesse Purser. Yeah, there's like, you know, maybe the art world actually at the moment has world crafters instead of sculptors or painters. Maybe there's sort of a new genre that...
But to me, it seems that there are definitely a lot of world crafters, but at the same time, there coexist a lot of sculptors and a lot of, you know, people working with traditional media. It's just amazing how a lot of things coexist, and whatever deep you dig, you will get very deep. In both traditions, you know, like, and then there are so many different art scenes and so many different takes on art. And I liked what you said also in the beginning, that you are lucky as Om Social Club to exist in art world, because it really is protecting you from, say, medieval structures of society. And
I mean, also just economically as well, you know, we're so lucky that for our works, because of having the support and backing of artistic institutions, that we can allow people to participate in them for free. This is very different to the LARP world. You can pay a huge amount of money to participate in role-played games.
But then you have everything prepared for you, kind of. They give you the costumes, they give you the set of instructions and everything.
We do that too.
Oh, you are also. Like,
We look after, I mean, care is a fundamental part of our world building. Like, you need to care for the body so the body can transgress.
Yeah, you're right. It's just still a very a big need from the participant to actively participate, to use his or her or their imagination.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I think that's also quite amazing and something that we never really expected to happen, that there would be such such a valuable set of imaginations that are kind of given. And as far as I understand, that's also because the people who participate say that they get so much out of it to take away. So they give a lot in and then they get a lot out because, you know, everybody's giving a lot in. So
there is a circulation.
Yeah, very much so. And I think that's really what has allowed OMS to grow, and to grow so quickly, is by the people who've participated. And because I think a lot of the first works that we did, we didn't really document them, mostly by being afraid to document them because they were so much still testing sites and it felt unnatural to document them. And
document in a traditional way?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the only documentation that came out quite a lot of the early work was the documentation of gossip. So people who participated would then tell stories about participating, and that would get more people interested to participate. And yeah, I think that really was something very unplanned and quite remarkable, that there was, yeah, a lot of generous participation, and still is. And that's what allowed the scene to grow, and also the practice to grow strongly and to keep getting amazing people coming in through the door to work on worlding. Like,
on one hand, I feel like we already have spoken a lot, but there is also one thing that I remember from our last conversation, how you mentioned that, like, for a moment when the internet art just appeared, that you became afraid and you just stopped making art, or like being part of the art world for a bit. And I'm trying now to come to this, why I remember this now, when you mentioned about care and those communities, structures or ways the community is built and sustained, and through actually like care, self-care, but at the same time caring of each other. Okay, let me ask you like that. It just seems to me sometimes that the aesthetics, not only OMS Social Club, but more like this part of the art world, is not exactly reflecting the relationships inside. I don't know if I'm clear.
I understand. I totally understand what you mean about this idea that there's a kind of coldness, or at least a lot of people predetermine this type of aesthetics as a space of almost like harsh realities. And I think this is also very kind of sad in a way, because every community is in a way in today's world on survival mode. And
community as such.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you could say a community of school kids, you know, a club community, a housing project community, yeah, a community of workers. You know, everybody is trying to survive. And I think that the aesthetics of like what OMSK works within are the aesthetics that we live within. You know, this is also somehow like real gameplay. You know, these aesthetics, these symbols, these unifying references, they are extracted from the worlds that like we continually have been living in. you know, whether that be from like, yeah, techno club culture in Berlin, which of course, like a lot of our works are in Berlin,
right,
with people participating within these scenes. So, you know, that is the bleed, that those spaces, they are our point of reference and they are articulated within the work because that's their foundations. It's not about like remaking something or reappropriating something. It literally is like, you know, growing out of there. And I think also this is really important that like UMS Social Club is not for everyone. It is for everyone to be able to come and participate within, but it's a very specific social, political, emotional,
intellectual, even.
Yeah, context that it's working within. And I think that's also something that, you know, some people can read that as exclusive, but there's also a reason that we get so deep into our topics, and that's because the people who come are already informed. And all, but when I say that they're already informed, you don't have to come with like a certain CV or a certain book list, but they're informed by their own self-knowledge and their own personal education. And, you know, these can be from very different parts of the conversation. And that's actually where I think the real kind of key or like boiling pot of UMSC is that a lot of people are coming from their own inquisitive self-knowledge, but are then mixing together. And there's a there's this sense of generosity there. There's also this sense of unlearning. I think also like being here and listening to Tod Vidas talk a lot about like alternative education. I mean, also, I think there's a lot of similarities there of like particularly, I spoke about earlier, this book that came out. This book was written by practitioners who were particularly involved in, you know, the questions of like emerging metaverses and avatars and coding bodies or heart spaces and safe spaces. So there's already a huge kind of history of knowledge and from these practitioners before they even building this world together. I think, you know, some of these aesthetics, some people may see them as cold or demanding or aggressive. They're also quite often non-gendered.
True.
All of the characters that we ever work with are non-binary characters. If the character is gendered, it's gendered by the player, not by us. There is kind of quite a lot of fluidity of these scripts that come in. But yeah, this is also people's safe space. You know, it can be someone else's cold space, but it can be someone else's safe space. Right?
Totally. I mean, I think my wording here in calling it cold or something is more like I'm just maybe in general, I'm interested in aesthetics as such, mm-hmm. and how appears certain styles, how like we attribute certain styles, how we choose certain styles, you know, like coming from, I don't know, teenagers. I mean, in earlier societies, like, you know, to choose a style is to choose a life. My best friends at school, we were four of us, and we each had different subcultural style. But we were, like, all the time hanging out together, you know? But because we didn't have peers in school, just maybe outside. So, but, and it's more like, how do you
like
attribute an aesthetic?
Compass.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, I mean, but in general, like, how do you attribute that? And that's maybe my, in general, also broader questions for the post-internet aesthetics in general. That, of course, I realize that it comes from the digital interface, from the digital world, from that kind of qualities, but you are right to correct me in calling it, attributing it certain meanings, because as you said, for someone, it's a safe space, and actually it's true.
I mean, also, I think, you know, artists of my generation, like, we also grew up in, like, Y2K. It was supposed to be the end of the world.
Yeah, you know? True. Like,
I think this, like, moment of, like, millennial meltdown, like, really was quite undeniably instructive. Yeah, maybe, like, visual and aesthetic identity.
Also true. But you know what you said, that also, of course, there is a strong sense of Berlin in this, that and at first I kind of had the question in my mind, what if Om Social Club was, say, in London or in Paris? But at the same time, it seems like maybe it wouldn't be possible, because I don't know if there is any city more community engaging than Berlin today.
I mean, I think, like, I mean, we've worked definitely, like, all over the world. Yeah, in terms of it existing within Berlin, I think that's also the conversations, the people, the thoughts, the politics, the policies, the conduct, the care, the difficulty, the internationality of, like, existing together,
yeah,
is like really what feeds and fascinates, like, the process.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot, Social Club. We delved.
Wow, there's like some tough ones, morning. I was like, whoa, okay, I'm not used to that.
But you know, I mean,
it was good. You like got me in my. Very probing.